Sunday, June 24th, 1973, New Orleans, the edge of the French Quarter. It was a hot, muggy night, and despite it being the Sabbath and not as loud or as crazy as Friday or Saturday night would be, the tourists and partiers were still out in full force. The 20-something man staggered down Iberville Street. He was muttering to himself, dangerously off balance, the kind of drunk that you knew liked to fight just by looking at him. So the people walking near him gave him a wide berth. He had just been physically thrown out of a bar by the staff after they discovered him doing something gross and against the rules. Due to the way they treated him, all they could see now was red. It was a mere two-minute, two-block walk between the bar on Chart Street and his destination, the pharmacy on the corner of Iberville and Royal. It's still there, present day. He lurched in, a young white man with a medium build and dark hair, and he approached the counter with a definite goal in mind. Despite his slurred speech and staggering, the cashier was able to make out what he was asking for. He wanted to know where the lighter fluid was kept. You're listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things. This is episode 10, Scorched Earth, the Upstairs Lounge Fire. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jay Harvey, and this is the 10th episode of Wicked Gay, which is a big deal because unless I'm getting paid, my stick-to-itiveness on projects, finishing stuff, is kind of lax. So yeah, this is a big deal for me, and that sound you hear is me patting myself on the back. I mean, the pandemic has changed people because I cook now too. It's crazy. Oh, and I'm happy to announce that we're ending on a down note because this story is really tragic and horrible and should definitely be told, because life for gay people in New Orleans back then and the response to this disaster was a definite injustice. And I know this podcast is supposed to be entertaining and I have plenty of straight listeners. Well, the word plenty is probably not the word to use, but I know that I have a whole spectrum of listeners here, and I don't want to politicize the podcast too much because it's supposed to be entertaining, but when I read or hear about gay people being fucked with, I'm going to point it out and bitch about it. So you guys know that. So now, there's fires that you've heard about throughout history here in the U.S. You've probably heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. You probably heard of the Coconut Grove fire that happened here in Boston. The MGM Grand in Las Vegas in 1980, and the Station nightclub fire in Rhode Island, which, shiver. But you probably never heard of the Upstairs Lounge fire, and there's maybe two reasons. One of them is that, I'm not going to say the word only, but 32 people were killed as a result, which is a lot less than the casualties that happened in the other fires. The other reason is that everyone who died in the fire pretty much was a gay person. And back then, in New Orleans, as in other places, 1973, people considered gays, for the most part, to be valueless as human beings. So after this fire happened, there was hardly any concern or help offered or publicity or outpouring of sympathy. And as a comparison, the year before this, on November 29th, 1972, a 17-story building caught fire in New Orleans downtown, and it was a horrific fire that took six lives. Those six lives, that's horrible. Terrible, it's a tragedy. But six lives, it got a ton of newspaper coverage, of course. The governor, the mayor, the archbishop, everybody, a day of mourning was declared. People wanted to help and wanted to talk about it and wanted to acknowledge how awful it was. In the Upstairs Lounge fire, 32 people, 31 men and one woman, were horribly killed, and you could have heard a pin drop. The governor, Edwin Edwards, never acknowledged the loss of life. The mayor did. His name was Moon Lindrow, only after he was pressured. Oh, I should point out here that this story takes place down south in Louisiana, in New Orleans, in Cajun country, and there's a lot of French names, French-sounding names, that I'm going to mess up. It's just going to happen, and I'm sorry in advance, but I'm just bad at pronouncing things, and please don't take offense. I beg you. Thank you. The archbishop only referred to it obliquely in a church newspaper. there would be no day of mourning or public memorial for these 32 people. Probably because, well, let's face it, it was because it was a, quote, queer bar that burned down and queer people who got killed. And by the way, that was Major Henry Morris of the New Orleans Police Department calling it a queer bar. That was in a newspaper report. In New Orleans back then, it was set up so if you were gay, there was kind of a citywide don't ask, don't tell. I mean, granted, this was 4 years after Stonewall, so gay civil rights were just becoming a thing, but in other cities, they were becoming a thing. In New Orleans, through kind of a tacit agreement between the straight people and the gay people, you didn't talk about it. I mean, there were gay bars and restaurants, and gay people were part of the very colorful New Orleans tapestry, but you weren't out. Most people were in the closet, and in the closet with their families, in the closet at work, in the closet everywhere. That's how it was. There wasn't activism, there wasn't gay pride, there was just, you kept your head down, lived your life, and hoped the cops didn't notice, and that your place of business didn't find out and fire you for it, or your landlady didn't find out and evict you for it, because that was legal back then, all of that was. The fact that it was gay people who were horribly killed, that's pretty much the big reason why the Upstairs Lounge fire was kind of ignored by history for a very long time. And until the shootings at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando on June 12th, 2016, the Upstairs Lounge fire was the worst mass killing of LGBT people in U.S. history. Roger Dale Nunez was a gay man who worked as a hustler, who allegedly became an arsonist, and then tragically a mass murderer. I keep having to say allegedly. We can't say for sure that the fire was his fault or that he set the fire, but all signs point to it was his fault to set the fire. So you'll see as we go along. His multiple confessions afterwards point to him being responsible. Well, he was a shady, seedy character with few friends who mostly annoyed the people who knew him in the city's gay community back then. But, you know, the more I read about him, the more I felt bad for him. I mean, part of me was like, you know, fuck that guy. But he was an awkward, wayward guy who hated himself because he was gay and had serious health problems. And he was a lost soul. And it reads like his anger took over for one moment, but that moment resulted in a terrible tragedy. And he had to live with that for the rest of his life, which I'll get into in this. The book I use for the majority of the research for this episode is called Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation by Robert W. Fiesler. Let me tell you a little bit about the Upstairs Lounge, and it's kind of up in the air whether it's two words, upstairs or upstairs. So to describe the place, it's on the edge of the French Quarter, kind of a seedy neighborhood known for hustlers. And I remembered I should probably explain this. A hustler in gay terms is a guy, is like a male prostitute. It's a guy doing it for money. So it happens. What? Anyway, so a lot of hustlers in this neighborhood, but the upstairs was kind of the nice bar in that area. Friendly, welcoming, that kind of thing. Not as much as you'll see, hustlers weren't allowed. So there was a canopy outside on Charts Street, read simply in cursive, upstairs. The actual address was 604 Iberville Street. There was a wrought iron door, which behind it there were 13 wooden steps to climb. The building that the upstairs was in was said to be at least 100 years old. And the bar wasn't the easiest to find, but that was kind of the point. Out of the way, kind of hidey hole for gay guys and women to congregate safely. Everything in the bar was red, or in the area of red. Red wallpaper, red carpeting, red fabric streamed across the drop ceiling. There were red bar stools. And the bar was three spaces. There was the main bar area. There was a white baby grand piano on a little stage, and there was a jukebox. The bathrooms were supposedly tiny, so there was always a line for them. On the far wall, Burt Reynolds' famous 1972 centerfold from Cosmopolitan was up there. You know, if those of you who don't know, Burt posed nude for Cosmopolitan, and he just had like his arm over his junk, and it was very famous. And there was a microphone behind the bar, and the bartender and general manager was named Buddy. Buddy's a main character in this story. So Buddy kept a microphone behind the bar, and he was in the habit of making like the announcer from like The Tonight Show whenever a patron walked in that was a regular. So he'd be like, "Here's Jay," which that's nice. It's very Cheersian, huh? Right. And then a long archway led out of the main bar area to a smaller space with more tables and a dance floor. They called the dance area. And beyond the dance area was a third space. It was actually a theater with a stage, chairs for the audience, the whole thing. They would host stage productions they refer to not melodrama, but as Nelly dramas, as well as meetings for the local Metropolitan Community Church, which is the gay church I talked about in episode 5 that Troy Perry started that was by this time nationwide. So yeah, New Orleans had I'll call it the MCC, had an MCC church in its city. And for a while, they didn't have a place to congregate, to worship. And so the upstairs opened up the theater part of the bar for them to worship at. Many of the regulars, a lot of the regulars at the upstairs were also members of the MCC. Buddy was known as the heart and soul of the place, and his lover, and they kind of used the word lover back then. People couldn't get married, obviously, and partner. They didn't really use partner or boyfriend. They said lover. His lover's name was Adam, and Adam Fontenot, and who was a regular at the bar, a lovable drunk who often played the upstairs piano and sang jazz tunes. For a gay bar in a chaotic town like New Orleans, Buddy ran the upstairs in a no-nonsense manner. There were rules, and if you didn't abide by them, it was GTFO. For instance, like I said, New Orleans had a thriving hustler industry. Hustlers could drink at the bar and meet and date other patrons. They just couldn't work their trade there and do it. They couldn't meet and date patrons professionally, let's put it that way. I mean, there were bars in that area that were fine with hustling. Some of them were called The Cavern. There was one called Wanda's. There was a gay bar for gentlemen of color called... the Safari Lounge, which, dear God, you couldn't fool around in the upstairs, so nothing naughty in a dark corner or a bathroom stall. I know, men, right? There was, though, a, quote, small hole drilled in the wall separating the two bathroom stalls and the men's room, and make of that what you will. And I should point out that was drilled there by an enterprising upstairs lounge patron and not the establishment. Drug use and drug dealing weren't allowed. If you got sloppy drunk, you were either asked to leave or Buddy got you a soda or a cup of coffee and then a cab home. You know, those rules were rarely broken. Hence, this bar was seldom raided, or I don't think actually was raided by the cops, because it was common in New Orleans at that time and in other cities for the cops to regularly raid these gay bars, and you could be arrested for making physical contact with another guy on the dance floor. The upstairs bar was the first gay bar to receive a dancing license in New Orleans. It was a place where discretion was assured because New Orleans, if you were in the closet, no one was going to out you there. Because blackmail was a thing. Revenge by a scorned lover was a thing. People could drop a dime on you. Here's a statistic you should know. There were 75,000 gay guys living in New Orleans in 1971, but fewer than 1,000 could be called out. They made it so gay guys could be safe there. It was a place for closeted guys from all over the South, actually, to relax and let their hair down. Something else that struck me about something they did at the end of every Bear Bust was to gather around the piano and sing that song called United We Stand by the Brotherhood of Man. It's from the 60s. It would be a good gay solidarity song, and obviously it was because they used it. I can't play the song now because I'd get sued for $1 million, but it's corny, but it's good. So what happened on a Sunday, and Sundays were very popular at the upstairs, unfortunately. They had beer busts. Between 5 and 7, you paid $1 for a mug, and you had unlimited beer the entire time. And also, the MCC guys would come over after church on Sundays, so it would be at capacity. And the capacity at the upstairs was 110. So that Sunday, there was a lot of people there. Luckily for a lot of people... Well, for some people, when the beer bust ended at 7 p.m., some people did leave, leaving about 60 people at the bar, including the staff. Don't those beer busts sound really fun, though? I mean, 2 hours of unlimited beer with all your friends and, you know, also, if you turn the mug in, you got 50 cents back. So it was 50 cents to drink all that beer. Fantastic. And I'm totally outing myself as a drunk. Yeah. And now that I've set the scene, let's get into Roger Nunez a little bit. And Roger originally, until he changed it, had a D in it. So R-O-D-G-E-R. I don't know why you would drop the D. It actually makes the name kind of cool. He grew up in a town called Abbeville in Bayou Country. It was so Bayou that a lot of the townspeople preferred to speak French rather than English. He was the third child of four, the son of a Coast Guard veteran, and his parents divorced in 63, which is a big deal because it was a heavily Catholic region. And also, what was a big deal was that he was gay. So that inspired a lot of self-hatred in Roger. He left home before he even graduated from high school. He applied for the army at the age of 17, despite having epilepsy, and he answered no about on his application about having any neurological issues. From 64 to 67, he served in the army as a typist, first in his home state of Louisiana, and then in Frankfurt, West Germany, which let him bypass Vietnam. Something mysterious happened at some point, an injury that was never explained in his record, and he was transferred back to the States, and he recovered from whatever happened in a Georgia army base. And that's where he served out the remainder of his military career. It's not sure where Roger ended up after his discharge in 67. He was released from a state mental hospital in 1970. After that, he went to live in New Orleans. So Roger had a lot going on, obviously. In December of 72 and April of 73, he was arrested twice. He was arrested for using stolen credit cards. And at the time of the upstairs lounge fire, he was in violation of his probation for those charges because he'd been failing to report to his parole officer, and he'd also given the parole board a false address. Roger was a big drinker, and he would mix booze with his anti-seizure meds. He would have bad seizures, then go back to drinking, which his friends, or more like friendly acquaintances, found alarming. On the day of the fire, before the beer bust at the upstairs, he was at a different bar called Jean's Hideaway, and he was plying his trade. Roger was living with a woman named Cece at the time, who had felt sorry for him and let him sleep there, but he didn't really have any friends. She later on told the cops that they weren't besties, and as a matter of fact, she said she didn't know Roger. Nobody did. Roger that afternoon was trying to get with an elderly man named Donald who had money and a colostomy bag. The things we do to make a living, right? Roger was full court press on Donald, flirting heavily, trying to score free drinks, and maybe get taken home by him. Unfortunately for Roger, professional competition sauntered in at this point in the form of a fellow hustler named Mark. Mark was a friendly acquaintance of Roger's, but Roger probably didn't consider him to be that friendly in this case, because he was trying to, in the parlance of the day, nip Roger's trick, which he did. Eyewitnesses reported Roger drunkenly stomping around Iberville Street, venting his rage over the loss of his trick. So Roger was already in a bad place emotionally that day, until he went back to Jean's Hideaway at around 5 p.m. Coincidentally, that was when colostomy bag Donald and hustler Mark re-entered as well. And Roger was ballsy, and he actually bitched to Donald about going off with Mark. And he guilted him into giving him $20, which back then was worth, I looked this up, $117 spending. So he got a lot of money out of Donald out of guilt. He might have wanted to calm down because the bitch still got paid. And right before he left, he told Donald and Mark they were going to the beer bust at the upstairs with him. He demanded this. And before he left, he dumped all his money on the bar and made the barmaid, one of the barmaids, split his 20, break his 20 into two 10s. And that will be important. And, well, Mark and Roger went to the beer bust. Roger drunkenly makes it over to the beer bust, which is almost 100 people strong at this point and reportedly raucous. The staff weren't exactly happy to see him. He'd visited before and was known to be a hustler. And every report about him said that he tended to turn people off, whether it was his attitude, his anger, or just the vibe he gave off. Even the friendly gay guys were kind of eh about Roger. He was troubled. And trailing behind Roger was his sort of friend, mostly competition, Mark. Roger immediately headed for the bathroom, and Mark, seeing the unfriendly looks that him and Roger were getting, he dipped out. He was like, I'm out of here. Roger camps out in the bathroom stall, one of the bathroom stalls, and he begins utilizing the peephole that was there to check out what was happening in the stall beside his. He was whispering, creepy, either words of encouragement about what he saw or harassing the people in the next stall in some sort of reverse psychology attempt to get them to go home with him. So, yeah, Roger was a total creep show. And his bathroom stall judging booth stint created an even longer line than usual for the bathroom that night, and people began to get pissed off. At that exact same moment, upstairs head honcho Buddy was having to deal with a teenage drunk who was trying to steal people's empty beer steins so he could turn them in for the 50 cents to use to drink some more. So, smart plan, kid. Buddy and the rest of the staff were onto his scheme, and they cut him off. And in retaliation, this kid starts pouring beer on the floor and kicking other patrons while screaming. It was a wild night at the upstairs lounge. So the teen wonder, whose name was David, cut the bathroom line, and he begins pounding on the stall that Roger Nunez is in. Roger didn't budge, so David propositioned a man at the sink, saying, "Hey, I'll blow you for a sawbuck," and the kid was on fire, basically. And my favorite is the guy's response was a quote. He said, "No, you're just trash," which, yeah. His intended customer makes a beeline for Buddy and says, "Okay, Teen Wonder's in there offering blowjobs to people." At that moment, a dude in the stall beside Rogers realizes there's a guy in the other stall eyeing his nether region and whispering stuff about it, whispering comments. So poor Buddy had to deal with two drunken idiots. He and another staff member grab Roger first, got him out of the stall, told him to cut the shit. Roger, realizing someone narked on him, the guy from the other stall, he somehow figures out who it was and makes a beeline for the dude who was at a table with his boyfriend beside the piano. So he comes up and he starts bitching the guy out, and the guy stands up and cold cocks Roger in the face. So Roger's laid out on the floor. You know, he's writhing on the ground and complaining and groaning. And then Buddy and the staff member see this, pick him up, and then cart him towards the door to get him out of there. The guy who punched him later tells the cops that he hears Roger scream over the din of the busy bar, "I'm going to burn you all out." The guy whom the teenager, whose name was David, by the way, whom David propositioned to the bathroom, happened to be standing nearby and said he heard Roger yell, "I'm going to burn this place to the ground." What's important here is that both guys later told the cops that they absolutely audibly heard the word "burn" shrieked over the noise. And it took Buddy and two other guys to get Roger out of the bar. He was kicking and spitting. So Roger gets tossed out the front door and onto the street. And when they got back inside, blowjob insurrectionist David was dancing with two stolen beer mugs. They drag him out, mugs and all. He gets mad at them and starts beating the bar with the mugs, like shattering the mugs. So we're back to the beginning. Drunken, enraged young man shows up in the pharmacy nearby. The cashier, who was a lady named Claudine, she noticed that A, the guy was totally inebriated. B, he was probably gay because, in her words, he was feminine-ish. Feminine-ish? Yeah. Wow, gender roles, Claudine. And C, he was, in her words, emotionally upset. So upset, she said, this guy's hands were visibly shaking. But the customer's always right, and can you imagine the kind of shit that goes down in New Orleans? So, you know, he asked her where the lighter fluid was. She went to show him. He picked out a yellow can of a brand called Ronsonol, which is commonly used as the fuel in Zippo lighters. And the pharmacy normally sold it in small, medium, and large cans. And this guy asked Claudine, "Where's the small can?" And she's like, "Sorry, we're sold out of that." So he did want just the small can, but he ends up buying the medium can, 7 ounces, and he leaves. And back at the upstairs lounge, the horrible future was rushing at them and no one had any idea. And it's about 8 p.m. Buddy's counting out the register and he's getting ready to pass the bar over to a guy named Hugh. All he had left to do was to put the money in the safe, collect his boyfriend, and they were going to go out for dinner with another couple from the bar. And people were drinking and partying and talking, and they're actually awaiting drag queens who were coming to perform that night for charity. And downstairs, someone, and all signs and later police reports point to it being Roger Dale Nunez, emptied a can of lighter fluid on the bottom steps of the bar, the wooden steps. The more than 100 years old wooden steps. While this guy was doing that, whoever it was, he unknowingly dropped two $10 bills out of his pocket. And then he lit the lighter fluid. This is when witnesses in the neighborhood started reporting that there were big clouds of oily black smoke just pouring out of the entrance to the upstairs lounge. And so people went back to call the, firefighters, and they didn't have 911 back then. They had a 7-digit emergency number. 7 fucking digits. Really? How many people died in fires or accidents or just kind of bailed out of life because of 7 digits you had to dial? You had to recall 7 digits. I would be dead. Everybody would be dead around me. No one would survive. And upstairs in the bar, there is a metal door with no window in it. That's the entrance door. You know, no one has any idea what's happening outside. And a witness later described the stairway from the witness's angle, from what they were seeing, as the doorway to hell. It was completely engulfed in flames. They're in the bar, and the downstairs buzzer starts going off. And Buddy's like, what the hell? Usually that buzzer is for a delivery or if a cab driver's there to pick up a drunken patron. But it keeps going off. And, you know, later on, they're not sure whether it was an electrical short or whether somebody was trying to warn them from downstairs. So Buddy asks a man named Luther, who was an upstairs regular and a member of the Metropolitan Community Church. He asks Luther to open the door and yell down and see what was up. Have you all seen Backdraft? Okay. You know in Backdraft, when you open the door and the air rushes in and what happens? That's exactly what happened. The author of the book that I used for the research for this episode, he got really deep into the science of what happened and what happened to the people. And that's when I actually... And this is rare for me because I can take a lot of like horror stuff, but that's when I really had to start skipping paragraphs because it was brutal. What happened to the people in the upstairs lounge was brutal. Some people made it out, as it seems like the devil is shooting a flamethrower across this bar and people are, you know, not lucky. Buddy kept his head about him. He grabs a flashlight, jumps over the bar, yells at his drunk boyfriend Adam to follow him, and then starts grabbing everybody around him by the elbow, by the neck, by the shirt, whatever, and screaming, follow me, follow me, follow me. Buddy leads this group of guys through the bar, through the dance area, to the theater and back. He goes up on the stage and starts tearing down the scenery from the last play, and it turns out there's an emergency exit back there. And it opens up onto the rooftop next door, and Buddy ends up saving, like, 20 of these guys. In the bar, the windows, this is horrible, the windows had iron bars over them to prevent, because the windows were ceiling to floor length windows, so they wanted to prevent drunk people from going out the window, and so they installed those bars, which kept people who were trying to get out of the windows in the bar while it burned. Where was Roger Dale Nunez in all this? Roger walks into Wanda's, that bar, on the corner of Iberville, and he's within eyeshot of the fire, and he's out of breath and he's panting, and someone says that he's covered in soot, and he loudly tells the bartender and he says to him, thank God I just made it from the fire. No one knew about the fire yet, so they're like, what the hell are you talking about, drama queen? The fire itself, the bad part of the fire, took about only 19 minutes. And because people were trapped in the building, the people on the street watched some of them, what happened to them. And they said one of the worst things besides the screams for help were when those screams for help died down and all you could hear then was an eerie silence and just like the firemen shouting orders. And the worst thing, one of the worst parts of this, one of the worst little details, is that A photo made the papers, made the rounds of the papers, the newspapers the next day, because it was reported on. They just didn't mention that it was a gay bar. A man from the church, Reverend Bill Larson, did not make it out the window. He got stuck and was killed. And unfortunately, from whatever happened, his body, his whole body, was left, this is so bad, hanging out the window in full view of the street for about 4 hours while they fought the rest of the fire and made sure all the survivors were gone. So this poor man, you know, it's this incident's kind of symbolic of the aftermath of the fire, where the authorities seem to expend very little effort on bringing whoever it was to justice, leaving this poor man's corpse undignified hanging there for 4 hours in front of all his friends. Some good did come out of the fire. New Orleans gay community, they took the first kind of tentative steps towards activism. It would take a while for it to really get going because it was so entrenched that you were closeted back then and that the gays didn't rate at all. But many of the survivors of the fire became those activists. And, you know, they had to live with the pain of not only losing their friends and their chosen families, but they had to still, for the while, had to remain closeted. So some of these guys, after the day after the fire, the Monday, had to go to work and pretend that nothing happened, that they hadn't watched their friends burn or what have you. The response, it got like 2 days of press coverage. No one would talk about it being a gay bar. The TV gave it a couple minutes the night of the day after. The survivors, they would only interview them with their backs to the camera due to reporters' fears of legitimizing the gay lifestyle. And also, and well, I will say this too, and the victims' fears of getting outed. So it was a mutual agreement. Troy Perry of the Metropolitan Community Church came to town with other priests to help and organize memorials, and they were barely able to secure a church. They were laughed at. They finally did find a church. I think it was a Methodist church, when it turns out that the dude running it was a closeted gay guy. And while they finally had the memorial for the victims, and of course there's people in the audience sitting there who are burned because their friends are still in the hospital burned or dying. And at some point, well, I mentioned that activism started. At some point, someone found out that the news crews were across the street. So what was going to have to happen was that the 30 or so people that were at the memorial were going to have to go out the front doors and be on camera and be outed as gay. Troy Perry is preaching at this, and he says to them, "Oh, there's a side door we can all go out if you want to, so the cameras won't see us." And some woman in the audience, I'm sure it was a big Bull Dyke, so because I love Bull Dykes, said, no fucking way. We came in the front, we're going out the front, that's how we're going out." When I read that, I got kind of a little teary-eyed. And everybody went out the front door that day. They were like, "Fuck this. We just lost our family, and we're not gonna be afraid, at least right not now. Not right now, right?" It was just a black mark on New Orleans and American society in general back then. And as for Buddy, I should mention this too. His lover Adam didn't make it out. In fact, Buddy claimed that when he was down on the street, he could see through the window Adam still sitting on his bar stool where he had left him. So that's horrible. Let's follow Roger's story. Buddy, after the fire, after that whole thing happened, Buddy said later that he knew that this had something to do with the guys he'd thrown out of the bar. Outside, he ran into Mark, the other hustler that Roger had arrived with. And Mark told him that Roger was in Wanda's. He'd seen him. So Buddy tracks his ass down, drags him out of Wanda's, and drags him over to a cop. And he's like, "Listen, this guy got in a fight in the bar. I think he has something to do with it." Meanwhile, Roger's like trying to get away, but Buddy's stronger or whatever. And the cop ignores him at first because he wasn't used to gays actually addressing him in a manner which, you know, adults would, as opposed to being subservient and terrified. Finally, the cop got pissed off and was like, "You know, get out of here or I'm going to bust you." So Buddy had to let Roger go, and Roger slipped away. The cops did initially investigate the fire, the cops and the fire and the state fire marshals. So Roger goes back to stay with his friend Cece, just two doors down from the upstairs. Somehow, two investigators from the state fire marshal's office tracked him down. And one of them took him out to the hallway, and the other one stayed with Cece in the apartment. Now, Roger's jaw was swollen, presumably from that guy Michael decking him in the bar at the upstairs. So Cece later said that the interview outside started getting loud, and the guys finally left, and Roger came back in and said to her, "They think I started the fire, but I didn't." And then she also noticed his jaw at that point too, was like, "What happened to you?" And he didn't really say. And he said he didn't want to talk about it. In the meantime, the cops found the can of lighter fluid that was discarded by the steps, as well as the now two partially crispy $10 bills, presumably left by the arsonist. No one ever connected the $10 bills to Roger getting his 20 broken at Gene's Hideaway. and there were no discernible prints on the can, so the arsonist was safe for then, was safe for now. What happened next is crazy stupid. The two cops track Roger down, and they're going to haul him in, but he has a grand mal seizure, or he fakes one. But he probably actually had one, because he really had problems neurologically. And then they take him into the hospital, and the doctors there help him out with the seizure, but they also say that his jaw needs to be operated on, the jaw that he obviously got punched in at the upstairs lounge. So the doctors are like, he's going to have surgery, you can't talk to him now.
So the cops are like, oh, okay, just give us a call when he's awake.
No one ever did after Roger's surgery. He calls his mom to drive from Abbeville to pick him up, and he checks himself out of the hospital, gets in the car with her, and drives right the hell out of New Orleans. And the cops are like, to be honest, when they find out that Rod, their prime suspect for 32 murders, basically, has skipped out, they're like, eh, okay. The fire marshals, however, were a little more on the ball than the cops. It read like they were working two totally separate cases. They find Roger. He gets brought in. They want to give him a polygraph. The operator says because he's epileptic and taking a medication, an anti-seizure medication, it won't work. So they give him a voice stress analysis test, which sounds kind of, I don't know, does that really work? He fails that one. And it looks like, you know, he did it. And when this happens, his attorney Roger lawyered up. He leaves with the attorney. And then the fire marshals weren't able to get Roger back in for an interview until September. And at that point, he denied everything, said he remembered nothing. It turns out he had told them initially that his jaw was broken or whatever because three, of course, blame it on the black guys. Three black guys had mugged him for his wallet the night of the fire. This time he denied everything, denied the pharmacy, denied the being mugged, denied even being at the bar. He said he didn't remember how his jaw got broken. So he ends up moving back to New Orleans in 1974. He lives in a flop house called the Imperial Hotel, which is a funny name for a flop house. And he ends up sharing his room with a slightly older man named Ralph. And they're kind of a thing, probably because Ralph starts footing all his bills. And Ralph is head over heels in love with Roger. Who knows why? In the meantime, the owner of the upstairs lounge, Phil Esteve, he opens another bar called the Post Office in the French Quarter. And the surviving patrons from the upstairs lounge start hanging out there. So then, Mardi Gras, 1974, Roger meets Sister Mary Stephen Ledet, a Roman Catholic nun, at Mardi Gras. Hopefully she wasn't lifting a rope for beads. So the flop house had been taken over by the Catholic Archdiocese, and Sister Mary was checking out her new digs. And remember, Roger had grown up very religious. So he immediately takes to this nun, and he asks her for counsel, and she obliges. He kind of like cast her in his mind in a priest role, and that extended to, you know how in confession, priests supposedly can't tell anybody what you said unless someone is in immediate danger, I guess. So I guess he thought that nuns had this thing going on too, which they don't. They're just married to Christ. So he tells her he was gay. They become friends. She later tells the fire marshals that Roger was a mixed up human being. Yeah, no shit. And that he always said Sister Mary expected more of him than he could give. Arsonist and drama queen. He starts hinting around to her that he had done something very, very bad. And kind of like he's making off like he's this manly villain type, which is weird. And he eventually tells her, I think it was to make up for the gay revelation. And then he eventually tells her that he torched the upstairs lounge. She tells the fire marshals this in an informal interview. Then they make her come into the office or whatever, and she officially denies that she said that. She says, I swore to him I wouldn't tell anybody, and this is a mistake, and I realize that he thinks I'm like a priest, so I have to honor that. So she sounds as mixed up under that wimple as her friend Roger was. Oh, and Roger also confessed to his boyfriend that he set the fire too. They're drinking at Wanda's one night, and he actually tells him that night while drunk that he did it, and tells him several times after that he did it while he was drunk. He said that he set the fire with the lighter fluid he bought at the nearby pharmacy, and Ralph said that he wasn't sure whether Roger was sad about this or boasting about it.
This was after they broke up, and he told the fire marshals when they asked him, why didn't you immediately come to us and tell us? He said that he didn't believe him initially and that he still had feelings for him, so he didn't want to turn him in. So in April of 1974, Roger undergoes brain surgery to remove a frontal lobe tumor. That could account for a lot of things. Anyway, Ralph takes care of him. He starts dating a woman named Elaine. They met by chance when Roger was babysitting a Wanda's bartender's child and she was visiting. So despite possibly being a mass murdering arsonist with rage issues and fickle taste in men, Elaine falls hard for Roger. And he really went for it. He acted on how he hated being gay, and he sort of gleaned from stuff that the wayward sister Mary had said that if he got married to a woman, God would magically make him straight. So he tells everyone that he's in love with a woman. And he especially enjoyed telling Sister Mary this because, you know, I'm no longer into penis, now Jesus likes me, or whatever the bullshit is. It should also be noted that Elaine had money, the woman that he wanted to marry. And he was still suffering the ill effects from surgery and might have still had the remnants of a brain tumor. So they get married on May 17th, 1974. It turns out that neither Roger, nor anyone else in Elaine's orbit told her that Roger was gay, which he does on their wedding night. That's romantic. He also tells her that he's impotent, whether it's from being gay and she's a woman or in general, we don't know. And Elaine was sort of at an impasse with her life at this point. She had married a younger man who was ill, unemployed, had just confessed to being gay and impotent. Why tell her both? Just say the gay will cover the impotence. To this poor woman's credit, she tried to make a go of it. She even took his last name. Maybe she was really stubborn or whatever. It's an odd situation. She took his last name and let him live in a trailer in her backyard so they could sort stuff out. Just don't let him use the grill, Elaine. And as we know, in addition to troubled and in ill health, Roger was also a scumbag, in addition to being a mass murderer, possibly. He kept being a scumbag and began forging checks in Elaine's name and using them to drink at another bar called the Pirate's Den, which was also very near the remnants of the upstairs lounge. Was he a sociopath or was he torturing himself? You decide. And Roger's health worsened. Sometime in 1974, he checked into a mental hospital and was diagnosed with something called conversion disorder, which, I looked it up, is a mental condition in which a person has blindness, paralysis, or other nervous system, neurologic, symptoms that cannot be explained by medical evaluation. That's expansive sounding, and it sounds like it covers a lot. And after being back in a mental hospital, he scheduled another brain surgery for the fall. And even though she was letting him live in the trailer still, Elaine filed for divorce. So he was living a wretched life, really. In the early morning of November 15th, Roger killed himself by taking an overdose of his epilepsy meds, 3 bottles of barbiturates, and 6 cans of beer. Elaine let Ralph know that he had died, and Ralph called Sister Mary, and they mourned together. You know, Roger started off the story with nary a friend, and everyone making a face at his existence in life, so it's nice, I guess, that he killed 32 people. He was a troubled guy with mental health and health issues. I hate to say this, maybe it was guilt that did him in. But his autopsy revealed that he had a tumor in his cerebral cortex despite clear surgical attempts to remove it, in addition to lesions on the dura, which is the thick membrane tissue that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. So it's entirely possible that he couldn't regulate his emotions or behavior, and this had been going on for a while. It was a tragedy all around. And unlike quite a few of the men he allegedly killed, Roger received a Catholic mass with all of his family present and mourning him, and he was buried with full military honors in the family plot back in Abbeville. And many of the men who died in the fire, who were also veterans and had families, received none of that. In 1980, the fire marshals officially closed the case, naming Roger as the culprit. They also never alerted the survivors until in the 2000s that the case had been closed. It took years and decades, really, for anyone to pay attention to what had happened. But finally, in 2003, when everyone finally got a clue, people started actually addressing the fire, and art and memorials and books and documentaries. A permanent plaque was put in the sidewalk out front that read, out front of where the upstairs lounge had been, at this site on June 24th, 1973, in the upstairs lounge, these 32 people lost their lives in the worst fire in New Orleans.
the impact went far beyond the loss of individual lives, giving birth to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights movement in New Orleans. And if you'll give me a second here, I'm going to name the people who died. Willie Inez Warren, Eddie Hosea Warren, James Curtis Warren, Luther Boggs, Reverend William R. Larson, Dr. Perry Lane Waters Jr., Horace Skip Getchell, Leon Richard Maples, George Stephen Bud Matty, James Wall Hambrick, Larry Stratton, Joe William Bailey, Clarence Joseph McCluskey Jr., Adam Roland Fontenot, Ferris LeBlanc, Donald Walter Dunbar, Kenneth Paul Harrington, Gerald Hoyt Gordon, John Thomas Golding Sr., Douglas Maxwell Williams, Robert Bob Lumpkin, David Stewart Gary, Guy D. Anderson, Dwayne George Mitch Mitchell, Louis Horace Broussard, Reginald Adams Jr., Joseph Henry Adams, Herbert Dean Cooley, Glenn Richard Dick Green, Larry Norman Frost, and three unidentified white males who were actually buried in a potter's field, it just adds to the sadness. And that's the tragic story of the upstairs lounge fire. And seeing as this is the episode of Wicked Gay that happens before the holidays, our Wicked Good Gay is actually the Hallmark Channel because their movie, The Christmas House. Okay, I have a lot of friends who love the Hallmark Christmas movies, like just die for them. And I've seen maybe 20 minutes of one, and I've gleaned from that 20 minutes and the ads I've seen for them that it's the same movie over and over again. Some businesswoman goes back home and there's a guy who works at the gas station she fucks, and then it's under the mistletoe or something. Anyway, they look awful. But the one that premiered last month called The Christmas House featured a married gay couple, Brandon and Jake. And there they kissed and were trying to adopt a kid in this movie. And that's a big deal, right? That's for the at-home lady types who might not know any gays in rural farmland. And look, gays kissing and no one cares. And that's Wicked Good Gay for this episode. And I just want to take a second to thank everybody for listening to season one of Wicked Gay. I wasn't sure I could pull this off. And the fact that people actually downloaded it and listened and commented on it, told me they liked it or didn't like it. Actually, I didn't get any of those, but I got like it's three, maybe. It was enormously gratifying, and I'm very grateful. So thank you. Wicked Gay should be back season two in January, I hope, in the new year. So please stay tuned. And our theme song is You Won't Get Away With Murder by Gino and the Goons. You can find them on Spotify and Facebook. Additional music by JB. Cover art by Paul Chapman. Sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. You can find Wicked Gay Pod on the three big social media platforms. You can email me at wickedgaypod@gmail.com. And again, thank you and happy holidays. And please wear a mask because, science. You've been listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things.